Good morning and welcome all of you who made New Year's resolutions and for whom this is your spiritual gym that you've decided to come to the first Sunday of the new year. It's kind of interesting how we make these New Year's resolutions to shape up our outsides and our insides. And that, in a paragraph, was the sermon that I wrote for today and the one that I have thrown out, except for that paragraph. Life and nature are remarkable, and they are awesome, and they are awful. We look at the news this week, Christmas Day of all days, and see that earthquake, 9 point, which is unimaginable. Even for those that lived through the Northridge earthquake, and I personally felt that it was directly underneath my own bedroom. 9 is so much bigger by hundreds and thousands of times the way the Richter scale operates that we cannot imagine the power of the earth. We cannot imagine the power of nature. We cannot begin to calculate the numbers of thermonuclear explosions that take place in only a minute within the core of every star in our universe. We cannot imagine to understand and to feel the forces of continental drift, of the tectonic plates that move and slide and crash and shatter within our Earth. What it must have taken to pull South America and Africa apart from each other and set them drifting loudly and violently apart, creating oceans and trenches and fissures, raising up mountains and shattering other mountains. We cannot imagine those kinds of numbers, that amount of power. They are numbers, we can calculate them, we can look at them in a book, we can see them on a Richter scale, but we cannot truly imagine and understand and take in the forces of nature just on our tiny little planet. When I was in Mexico this last week, and it was hard to gauge what kind of story this earthquake really was, because we had only one television station at our condo that operated in English, and that was Fox. Fox doesn't really let you know what's important. It only lets you know what's loud. And so it was kind of hard to gauge what was going on in this country, particularly when the first response of this nation was $15 million, which doesn't begin to cater an inaugural ball. It was hard for me to know just what the impact was. But when the first numbers came out, and the first numbers were, oh my God, 12,000 people were killed in an earthquake. My wife felt shattered. Tears welled in her eyes. Because 12,000 people is an imaginable number. It's a number where if you fill the sports arena and San Andreas decided to turn over in his sleep and it crashed down and 12,000 people were lost, we can calculate that kind of number. But when 12,000 became 40,000, when 40,000 became 70,000, when 70,000 became 110,000, when 110,000 became 150,000, as the numbers went up, in a sense, our understanding and our compassion and our sense of being able to connect did not go up proportionately if it went up at all. We looked at the numbers and went, oh my God, those are terrible numbers. But they're too great for us to understand. We can't take, as human beings, so this is not a guilt rap, we cannot take, as human beings, the personal losses that we have experienced within our lives and multiply them by 2, by 4, by 6, by 8, by 1,000, by 12,000, by 100,000, by 1,000,000, by 6,000,000. It's impossible. It would shatter us as 2 tectonic plates shatter the lives of human beings. We can't do it. We have to personalize it. We have to look at the baby who was caught in the tree. We have to look at the picture of a human being in tears and in despair, at a body or a couple of bodies covered with sheets, because when you get to the tens of thousands, our humanity protects us against just what Al was talking about, not simply fear, but paralyzing fear. Numbers that close, not open, our hearts. We look at something like this terrible earthquake, this terrible tsunami, and we understand with our heads. We understand the need that is out there. We understand, because most of us who live in Southern California have felt an earthquake, and we can begin to try to extrapolate just what it might mean to the lives of those human beings out there that came to an instant end, those who were close to the epicenter, and came with unimaginable force. Most of us have been in an ocean. Most of us have been knocked under by waves. I grew up body surfing. I grew up surfing. I have been pinned by a wave for 30 seconds, 60 seconds. I have been pulled under and bumped and buffeted. I understand the power of 3 feet of water. I've stepped in a stream and been swept away out to sea. I was close to the sea, and it was not a big deal. But the power of just a little water is astounding. A tsunami is not a wave like the wave that you body surf at the ocean or that you surf with a board. When the Alaska quake happened and I was relatively young and a surfer dude, some friends said, whoa, there's been like a quake in Alaska. Let's grab our boards and go and see if there's a tsunami, dude. What a truly horrible idea that would have been. You see, it's not really a wave. It's the ocean. It's the ocean with all of its power that sweeps in. It's not whether it's 3 feet or 30 feet or 175 feet as one of the Alaska tsunamis was when it got focused by a steep continental shelf. But when water starts flowing towards the shore at 500 miles an hour and then encounters a continental slope and begins to slow and begins to raise up, this is not 3 feet of water by 30 feet of water. This is the Pacific Ocean, and it will crush everything in its way. We cannot imagine it. Even when you see those pictures, you cannot imagine the power and the indifference of nature. We look at that world. We look at the world of nature, at the shifting tectonic plates, at volcanoes exploding, at hurricanes hitting Florida, at lives being wiped out, and we stand around and wonder why. We want to create a reason. We want it to have some kind of purpose. Some kind of explanation, shifting tectonic plates. It just seems so cold. And I fear it is. I don't think that we can help, as human beings, wonder at why bad things happen to good people. I don't think we can help wonder at who is saved and who is killed. Why this one group of Christian missionaries kind of got the message and the motorboat started on the first pull and he got his kids out of there and they were saved. Was it his faith? I can't accept that. Was an innocent child killed because it was the wrong faith? I certainly can't accept that. This is nature. Not romantic nature, not romantic, but bloody in tooth and claw, and utterly indifferent to us and our desires and our lives and our plans. And whether it's a tectonic plate or a mole at the side of our face that we don't see and don't take care of, nature just does what nature does. We can't help but explain it. But what a tragedy when we actually believe the explanations. I can tell you religiously that oceans have been a source of fear, of trepidation, of terror since the beginning of human myth-making. In one pre-biblical creation poem, God wrestles the seas for 5 days of the 7 days of creation in order to tame the chaos. It's the reason that Moses parts the Red Sea. It's the reason that Jesus walks on the water. The sea is a symbol of chaos and death, of forces of nature beyond our control, beyond our understanding. And when we try to understand it, when we try to give nature meaning and morality, the disasters are almost as bad, sometimes worse, than the shifting of tectonic plates. It is significant that in Islam the world will end with an earthquake. I know that there will be some mullahs in Southeast Asia that will see this earthquake as a warning to the troops that this is God's wake-up call for you to be more orthodox in your observance, more connected to everything that's going on in the world. I know that sermon will get preached in some mosques. Is this a condemnation of Islam? No, because it's a condemnation of that sermon. Because that sermon was preached by Jerry Falwell after hurricanes in Florida, which were caused by gays in South Beach. It's the same kind of pre-enlightenment, magical and maniacal thinking. And it's the same kind that was preached by the head Sephardic rabbi in Israel, who said that the Holocaust was the fault of Jews who were not observant enough. That's the kind of nonsense that the answers to our why questions, our inevitable questions, bring. They bring disaster and a second victimization to those people who perished, who lost, and who suffered from those natural disasters. But we can't help it. That's who we are as human beings. And we have to resist that from time to time. The other thing that is so interesting about human beings is that we have a tendency to be afraid, to be very afraid, and we also have a remarkable tendency to live in almost complete denial. I saw pictures of holidaymakers who kept their reservations at Phuket, who flew in after the earthquake and the tsunami, who flew in because, oh, I got reservations here, and I'm going to take my time at the beach. Where's the waiter? I'm sorry, there was supposed to be cocktails served by the pool. Where's the pool? The whole village is the pool. Here were people who were living in absolute denial of the fact that a disaster had taken place. And it says something so wonderful and so terrible about human beings that I go back and forth on that. It is such gross insensitivity to the reality, and yet, when we look at the reality of the world and at human suffering and at the catastrophes that touch so many people in the world, on the other hand, we cannot be paralyzed by it. We cannot say, there is a disaster in the Southeast Asia, I will sit in sackcloth today. There is starvation in Africa, I will starve myself. There is racism and homophobia, so I refuse to smile. We human beings have to walk a very fine line in this world, because there is always suffering, and there is always loss. There is always the opportunity for fear, and there's always the opportunity to do something about it. We cannot control the world. In the foreseeable future, we're not going to control earthquakes and tectonic plates. They will crash, they will subduct, they will send out ripples of destruction, shards that will pierce hearts and lives and remain with us always, but there's so much that we can do about this world and for this world and for each other. We are neither the optimistic end of that humanism that says we are the measure of all things, the masters of our destiny, nor are we all helpless, perpetual victims. Like steering a sailboat, there are forces of nature beyond our control, but with our tiny little sails and our tiny little rudders, we can attempt to navigate those shores and those shoals, avoiding some but not all of the reefs, steering away from those disasters that we can foresee, but knowing that we cannot foresee all of the disasters. It is interesting what trauma does to a human being. The last paragraph of the sermon that you're not hearing was about Scrooge and George Bailey. It's a Wonderful Life and a Christmas Carol. Because when you think about those two Christmas chestnuts roasting on the open fire of Christmas celebration, they're the same story in many ways. Scrooge is a man who is traumatized by his father's disgrace and bankruptcy, and he turns that disgrace into a hard heart. His tears become a carapace of salt, isolating him from others and closing him off to the suffering and to the joys of the world. George Bailey is a man also traumatized by his father's failure, and it opens his heart to live a life of goodness, of decency, of generosity. When each one comes to a crisis of faith and sees what the world would be like if they continue along this path or if they had never been born, each one, as a consequence, gains some understanding of the value of every tiny individual life to all of the other lives in the world. Scrooge has an epiphany. Does it end all problems in Dickensian England? No. Does it end all greed and suffering and exploitation of labor? No. But it opens one heart, it saves at least one life, and it makes the difference that it can make. These are not messiahs. These are human beings who for a moment do the right and generous thing, even though it doesn't solve every need. George Bailey, does his life end all problems with savings and loans for all time? I don't think so. Does it save all of lives? No, but by saving his brother's life, who saved a platoon's life, the ripples go on and on. Two people affected by the same trauma, one closes down and one opens up. It is a big, a dangerous, a capricious complex world, and no one of us can solve all of its problems. But like Scrooge and Tiny Tim and George and his brother, each of us has power beyond our ability to imagine. Maybe not the power of a tectonic plate. Maybe not the power to raise up unimaginable weights of oceans, to make the Himalayas thrust into the sky, to sink other islands and mountains. But we have the power to bring light, to have our eyes open and our hearts open and our generosity open, not to make all of the difference, but to make the difference that we can.